I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When I bought my home in London more than 20 years ago, it was owned by a well-known British playwright. I thought that if I bought his house and sat in the same study where he'd written some of his most successful plays, maybe some of his talent would rub off on me. It didn't happen, but we grew to love the house as he had done. And one Sunday afternoon last summer, he knocked on the door with his now adult son, and he asked if he could come in for a cup of tea. He was sick with cancer, and he knew that he didn't have long to live. He wanted one last look at his old family home. Houses do that to people. They become so much more than walls and a roof. They become a part of us, a part of our memories. The smells, the noises, the feel of the rooms in which we experience so much, both good and bad. This hour, we're talking to two authors who've written about the old houses that became a part of their lives. And we want you to join the conversation to tell us about houses that are or have been important to you. What are the qualities that transform a house into a home? Are they like great loves? You're lucky to have even one in a lifetime. Can you call several places home over the course of a life? The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, my guests are Sarah Messer, author of Red House, which she describes as a mostly accurate account of New England's oldest continuously lived-in house in which she grew up, and George Howe Colt, author of The Big House, which is about the sprawling summer home on Cape Cod, where he and his family spent every summer for decades. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show. I'm going to get each of you just to tell us a bit about the house which forms the stories of your books. Sarah, the house you grew up in, what made it special?
Well, the Red House was built in 1647 by Walter Hatch, who came to Scituate, Massachusetts in 1634 when he was 8 years old. And he passed the house down through his family until 1965 when my parents bought it. And when they bought it, they kind of bought the whole Hatch legacy. Richard Warren Hatch, who was the great-great-great-odd grandson of Walter, gave us the original wills and family Bibles and a lot of letters and daguerreotypes. And my parents were really ready to kind of recreate themselves as New Englanders, and they just bought right into it. So I grew up in this house that had over 300 years of another family's history, floorboards worn from feet passing over them, and a lot of small, dark rooms and nooks and crannies.
But when you were a kid, was it all that, or was it just where you lived? I mean, did all that come later?
It was just where I lived. It's sort of like a fish that you're swimming in water and you don't realize what you're swimming in until you get thrown out of it. And it wasn't until I left the Red House. I lived there for 18 years, and then I left to go to college and grad school and other things. And when I came back, I realized not only was the house special and, you know, a really sort of strange and unique place to grow up, but the circumstances of being only the second owners of this house that was so old, it was also very special.
George, the house that you've written about was a summer home. It was a place you spent just a few weeks every year, and yet it did play this huge part in your family. Why?
Well, I think because it was a summer home, it was built by my great-grandfather in 1903, and he built it as a summer home, a very large summer home, and my family had spent every summer there since then. And for me, there was something special about it being a summer home. I think of summer homes as a sort of crucible for family life, where we're sort of at our most happy and sometimes at our most sad, because it's where we have nothing else to do but be together and do things together in our winter homes. And I think for my parents, it's been perhaps hard, because I didn't have that same feeling about the winter homes in which we grew up, partly because there were more than a few of them. We moved a lot when I was a child, but we always knew we were going every summer to the big house.
That was the constant.
Yes, and people from our extended family would come there from all across the country and gather there each summer.
That, to me, seems to be one of the things that makes a summer home difference. It tends to be where the extended family congregate. You see relatives whom you haven't seen since
yes.
the last time.
Yes, and you get to know the sort of farther reaches of your family in both In behavior and in geography and in chronology. You're there with your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and dozens of cousins. I think I, you know, had about 14 or 15 first cousins who would, at any one time, might be there.
Now, one of the things that comes through to me in both of your accounts is the weight of responsibility that an old house carries with it. Sarah, I mean, your family came to the Red House because the Hatches, as I understand it, just really couldn't take that responsibility anymore. And George, your family almost got rid of the big house because they decided the weight was too much. Isn't that a significant negative when you come to talk about an old house, Sarah?
Yeah, old houses are hard to keep up. And
expensive.
Yeah, and expensive. Richard Warren Hatch and his wife Ruth were getting on in age, and the Red House is an old, drafty house. I mean, it's a little better now that we restored it in the 90s and put some new materials in. But, yeah, it's expensive. Air blows through. But yet, at the same time, there's this questions of preserving it. Do you keep everything the same as your ancestors, you know, the ancestors left it? Or do you want to put in that new stove or, you know, window or something like that?
And in your case, there was the added ingredient that the first Mr. Hatch, who actually built the house, said in his will that none of his descendants must ever sell it. But they did.
Right. Well, to be honest, that will was revised about 8 years later because Antipas got knocked in the head and became not mentally capable of taking this jewel in the crown, you know, forward in time. But it was interesting, though, because the Red House at that moment changed from being this great ancestral place to the kind of the dowager residence, the place where, you know, the unmarried aunt and Antipas, who couldn't take care of himself, and the younger brother lived. And so whoever got the Red House got all those people.
Did your family feel any sense of guilt that they had somehow moved into a house that wasn't really meant to be theirs? Or did you, in a sense, inherit the Hatch family? Did you become part of the Hatch family?
Well, we didn't. Well, we became sort of adopted. My father was sort of an adopted somewhat son of Richard Warren Hatch. Richard Warren Hatch kept giving us things that belonged to the house, and they were very close, he and my parents, but not with the rest of the Hatch family. And yeah, I think that my parents, I don't know if they'd say guilty. I think they felt cautious and for years never touched or moved anything. And it was almost like we were being shepherds of the house or just sort of
living
stewards.
Living in a museum.
Yeah,
almost.
Living in a museum. And it's not until just recently that they've really started to embody the house.
George, that is a huge problem, isn't it, in any old house? What do you change? What do you leave the same? How much do you dare to change?
In our case, it was very little. And I'm not exactly sure why that was, but I think one of the things I wanted to say was there's also, rather than the physical responsibility of taking on the house, there's the emotional responsibility of keeping a house in the family that long. And I think for my family, there was a great sadness in seeing the house be put on the market, but there was also this slight, little tiny sense of slight relief. And I don't mean relief from the financial responsibility, although that was, I'm sure, part of it, but also the accumulated weight of all the ancestral history. In my case, it was 5 generations and 100 years. But so not nearly as long, for instance, as the Hatch family, but the house was the center of family life for so long, and you both feel, if we leave this house, if we give this house up, will our family fall apart the way the house will fall apart?
I sometimes got the impression almost that the house owned your family rather than the other way around.
Well, it's been compared a little bit to an albatross around the neck. That kind of a house can be a joyous thing and also a little bit of a weight around the neck.
If I say the big house to you like that, I mean, what image immediately flashes into your mind? Is there a moment? Is there a room?
There absolutely is. There's stepping into the house. There's a great big green oak door that is very, very heavy and sticks, as most summer house doors do that are very old. And you have to kick it at the bottom to get in. And the house was almost never locked, so you don't even have to have a key. But you turn it, you kick the bottom, and you step in, and all of a sudden you're in a little hallway. For such a large house, it's a very, very small hallway. But there in it, there is a deer head whose antlers support hats that have been saved over the course of 100 years, different hats. My Uncle Jimmy's tennis hat, you know, a Red Sox baseball cap, one of my great-grandfather's canes, that kind of thing. But when you step into that house, you smell the smells of the summer house and you feel the weight of the history.
And what age are you in your mind as you tell me that?
I'm 9 or 10 years old.
Okay.
And it's the summer of 1963.
Very specific.
Yes, yes.
Sarah, when I say the red house to you, the image immediately?
I think it's the house from the south side, which you would see a big center part of the house painted a very dark red with two L's going off on either side that are kind of covered with vines. When I was a child, I used to lie in the field and look at the house sort of from eye level and just sort of stare at it as if it was a person that just I was sort of fixated on. And so when I think about going home, I don't think about the formal side of the house. I think about that south side, the back side, which was the informal entrance, where actually it turns out all the hatches came and went through there too, through that south side.
Was it a good house to grow up in?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was a wonderful house to grow up in.
Because?
Well, I think because it had so much history in it. And
but kids aren't interested in history.
Well, that's true, actually. And at points, when I was a teenager, it was kind of a pain in the butt because you could not sneak home because it was so creaky. It would wake up my mother going up the back staircase, you know, just no way. You couldn't sneak around in that house because it was we'd betray you at every step. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to sleep over because it was sort of spooky and cold. It was very cold in the winter. And it was...
Did you ever say, why don't we live in a house like other folks live in?
Oh, yeah. My best friend lived down the road, Anne Marie Noyes, and she had a shag carpeting and beanbag chairs and big mirrors with lights in the bathroom. And I was amazed by all of this.
And you wanted it.
It was amazing. Yes, I did.
George, did you ever feel the same?
No. I think in my winter homes, I felt the same thing. I aspired to I wanted a modular ranch house with the shag carpeting and the color TV. But our big house in the summer lacked any possible amenity except for the ocean, the sky, and the grass outside. And I never wanted any other summer house. I felt very lucky to be in the one that I was in. And I thought, I dare say this sounds absolutely awful, but I thought everybody had a summer house like that. And it wasn't, of course, until I got older that I realized how
well, I was about to ask you, in fact, whether each of you does feel unusually privileged because by force of circumstance, nothing to do with your own particular efforts, you have had the opportunity to live in houses of this kind.
Absolutely. And it's something that I was certainly not aware of until I at least got to college and went out a little bit into the wider world.
Sarah, when did you start feeling that you had something good in that house rather than something that just made you different from your friends?
When I went to college, or maybe right after college, I wrote for Yankee Magazine, and I was writing about a lot of old houses, and I didn't even think about my own house until it came up in a conversation, and my editor said, hey, that's a great story. Why don't you write about that? I thought, oh, why don't I? You're right.
So. We're talking about houses and homes, what makes them special, what they bring to our lives. How do four walls and a roof become a cherished dwelling? Join us when we return after the break. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the charms and the challenges of old houses, the emotional tug that they exert, the enormous responsibility of owning and living in them. My guests this hour, the authors George Howe Colt and Sarah Messer. Each of them has written a wonderful account of the old houses that they called home. Our caller on the line, first up this hour, JB on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. JB, you have a story about an old home?
Well, it's not as old as what your callers are talking about. Actually, it's a 20th century house.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an experience just this past weekend, and just you know, your show just kind of hit on it, so I thought I'd call and share it with you.
Please do.
One of my earliest memories is moving into this house in 1972, and I can remember as a young child walking in and going, boy, I wonder who lives here. And, you know, of course, it was us who lived there. We were moving in. And last weekend, my father, who's now in his 70s, you know, he's bought a condominium, and I helped him do some plumbing work and put it on the market. And I, you know, just walked through the house, and it was empty, and looking at that stuff and just realized the fierce emotional attachment I had to that house.
Memories came flooding back, did they?
Oh, yeah.
Share one of them with us. What do you remember from your time
well,
there?
I'll tell you one of the ones that made mm-hmm. me laugh. Daddy made me keep the yard mowed because I earned extra money by mowing people's yards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the fee for him keeping the lawnmower was me mowing his yard for free. So, and I hated doing it because, you know, I didn't get paid for it in my eyes and all that. And would put it off and put it off and let the yard get high and things like that. And I tell you what, last Saturday, I'd give just about anything to mow that yard.
JB, thanks for that. Sarah, how much of what we're talking about is simple nostalgia?
Well, I mean, in some ways, you know, you choose what you want to be nostalgic about. And you choose that because of who you have decided you are as a person. And so, I mean, maybe I'm the wrong person to ask because I don't think nostalgia is so bad, you know?
And
so
it's hardly simple either.
yeah. And I mean, I feel like this house shaped the way I think. You know, these rooms, there's a great book by Gaston Bachelard called The Poetics of Space. And it's about how when you're a child, especially, but anybody who is in repose or resting, the shape of where you are resting kind of informs the dreams you have and the thoughts you have. And I feel like I am who I am because of these rooms that I walked through. Mm-hmm. So I don't, maybe that's nostalgic, but it also is on some deep level, like really connected to.
I guess what I was thinking of, George, was some people might feel that there's a risk at least that when you talk about old houses like this and you love old houses like this, you wallow in the past. You don't look at the present, you don't move on, you simply keep looking behind you.
I think that's probably absolutely true, but I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I mean, for me, the big house was a part of the big, beautiful, you know, mostly beautiful past, but it was, I mean, we shaped the house and the house shaped us, so it was sort of inescapable, and I think that, you know, in writing about the house and thinking about the house, I felt that if I could write about my own experience in that house and how it shaped me and we shaped the house, then it's the same experience as anybody has in any house.
So what do you think when people buy an old house and they tear it down and build a new one? Because it happens.
It happens all the time. It's happening on Cape Cod and Nantucket, just about everywhere. I'm deeply, deeply saddened, but I don't feel that it's necessarily a wrong thing to do or that they shouldn't do it. I think if there's great larger historical interest in the house, if it represents a certain time period or something and it has something that's irreplaceable about it, then I think that it is somehow wrong. But I also think everybody has the right to create their own world, their own house, and their house is their world. I mean, we just moved from New York City 4 years ago into sort of like the Red House, except it was built in 1807, and it's an old farmhouse. And because we'd just gone through selling the big house, I felt I could understand a little bit better what it meant to the people who had had that house in for so many years, what it meant to them to let go of it. But I must say, now that we're in the house and we've renovated it, it feels like ours. It feels like we're moving on. And we're all, I was thinking about this as I was driving to Boston today, we're all just renters in a sense. I mean, we buy our houses, but we're there for, you know, in Richard Hatch's case, 200 years, 300 years. In my case, in the big house, 100 years, my family. But 200 years from now, somebody else is going to have something there. And we want to enjoy the things while we can and get the most out of them.
Sarah, I want to talk to you about renovation in a moment because I know that that was an issue at a time at the Red House. But let's take another call first. Kathleen's on the line from Andover, Massachusetts. Kathleen.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Do you live in an old house?
Well, we did for 23 years. Right now, we're in a new house in Andover, Massachusetts. But in 1973, we and our three young children bought a very old house. It was over 100 years old, located in Akron, New York, outside of Buffalo. And we had plans for a new house at the time, to build a new home. We were working on getting property and all. My husband urged me to look at this old house in Akron where he was teaching school. And I reluctantly went, but when I walked in the door, I felt like it was my house and we belonged there. It was a very strange thing. And we gave up our plans for the new house, and we immediately bought this old house. We lived there for 23 years. In the mid-90s, we were talking to my mother and other relatives about my grandfather Foley, my father's father, who had been a baseball player at the turn of the century. We were looking for information on him and were stymied. My husband took out, at that time, an old window from the front hall of this house to make a closet. And when I said, save the window, it was colored glass, very beautiful window. Mm. He took the outer frame off and between the upper sash and the frame found one sheet of newspaper, accordion folded to keep out the draft. The window had been painted shut for years. My mother and I began looking at this sheet of paper because it was from a Buffalo Evening News, 1905. We found an article about my grandfather Foley and his baseball career.
That's amazing.
It still gives me chills.
That's extraordinary.
What a great story.
It told the team he played for, and it was the link that we were looking for.
That is absolutely extraordinary. Kathleen, thank you for sharing that with us. Sarah, that story, excuse me, about how Kathleen's family came to get that home, very similar to how your father bought the Red House.
Right.
Just walked through the door and said,
right,
I must have it.
Yes, absolutely. It was like falling in love. And they were planning to move to California. Mm. And my father drove up, had heard about the Red House and decided to go early. Drove up there. The Hatches were sitting outside. He came up, introduced himself, and they took him through the house. He went back to find my mother and my four siblings, and dragged them back in their pajamas. And my mother said the same thing that you said the minute that she walked through the door. She felt like she was home, and she had never had really a home before. So it was really important to her.
Can you explain, either of you, how a human being can fall in love with a constructed object with walls and a roof? Because it happens. I mean, all of us probably have stories about seeing a house or an apartment or a home and just saying, I want it. That's me. I feel we belong. How does it happen?
I'm not sure, but I think probably within us all there lies some kind of a template, both for the partner that we will end up being with, marrying or whatever, and also for maybe the kind of thing that we think of as home, as shelter. Now, that may be formed, maybe biologically hardwired into us a little bit, and it may be formed by what we grew up with, whether we react against it or whether we move toward it. In fact, there's a connection there it's often said that men marry their mothers. I think, houses are often compared to mothers as well.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something that home, maternal, whatever it might be, earth mother, that we have it inside us somehow. And whether it's biological or not, I don't know.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you about renovation. You talked about the feeling early on in the house that you didn't dare do anything, the family.
Right.
It was, you didn't dare touch. But over time, a house needs work doing on it. You want to install things that make life a little bit more comfortable. It's an issue, isn't it?
It's a big issue. And what happened with Red House is that my father was putting up a Christmas tree in 1995, and he lost his balance and fell against the living room wall and felt it move out and then move back. And then he trudged outside in the snow in his slippers and pushed on the wall, and from the outside he could move it out and back.
Oh dear.
As well. And so the whole entire wall was loose, and that was a problem. So,
yeah.
And also those rooms that in the old part of the house, I've described them as refrigerated areas we ran through to get to less refrigerated areas. In the winter, they were just impossible to sit in. My father had a dinner party right after they bought the house, and he was you know, determined to use those rooms. And everyone was in their coats and their breath. You could see their breath, and there was fire in the fireplace, and the heat was up, but everyone was still freezing. And one of his guests said, "Can you please just turn up the heat?" And he said, "It's already all the way up." And then I guess a breeze blew in and blew out some of the candles on the table. That was part of the story. I don't know if that really happened. But we wanted to, when we tore down that wall, we found a lot of things in the wall, but we wanted to make the rooms livable. And then there was the question of how do you do that and be historically accurate? I mean, a lot of... there's some materials that build out post and beam with sheetrock and stuff like that, but then you'd lose sort of the feeling of the beams. So we decided sort of a compromise of putting in a windbreak, which is kind of a material. And but it was a big debate. We had a big debate about it all summer, whether we wanted to do that or not.
Let's talk to John, who's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. John, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have personal experience of all this?
Well, yes, we have an old family summer house up in Gloucester, and it's a great old camp, and I'm constantly fighting to have nothing there changed at all. And I think it's very important to me in this society where everything's disposable. I mean, we don't have anything like a gold watch from my grandfather or anything like that. Everything that's produced now is basically disposable, and I really value this house and the stories. And other members of the family aren't so, you know, they would tear it down to build something nicer, or, you know, so to speak, nicer. But maybe we're stuck in the, I think the sentimental feelings are really, really important to some of us, of this sort of the sort of ageless, wonderful family artifact.
Is it a sense of somehow retaining a connection to the past, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we see all these big mansionettes going up, and it's, I feel those people are pretending to create what we actually have. You know,
John,
we actually have a history there.
Okay, thanks, John. George, you were talking about this idea that we only pass through. We're on our way from it, here to somewhere else.
Yes, it's probably because I'm trying to sort of justify feeling sad about not, you know, about the house not being the way it was or something like that. But I when I do see a McMansion go up next door, say to the big house, I feel that they're beginning to create their family crucible, and that it's that I have to try and be okay with that. I mean, they're doing just what my great grandfather did 100 years ago. They're finding a piece of land, they're clearing it off, and they're building a new house. I came across a photo of in doing the research for my book, I came across a photo of the big house the summer it was built, and it was shocking to me because it was like coming across a picture of my father when he was a child. You know, I never. I didn't know him as a child. I didn't know he could ever have been a child. Intellectually, of course, you do, but you don't really. And so seeing this house, which was, it had none of the ivy going up the sides, none of the honeysuckle, none of the wings that were added on later as a hermit crab, you know, adds on barnacles. And it was cleared. There were no trees around it because they'd had to clear the land. And I thought, this, what's missing from this picture? Well, this was a house, and it wasn't yet a home. And who knows what makes a house a home, but at that point it was still a house, and what I knew was, you know, 80 years later, was this home.
That is interesting. I mean, Sarah, there is a tendency, isn't there, to think that because something is old, no, it was always old. It wasn't, of course. Once
right.
It was new.
Right.
And once it wasn't special. Once it was just like everything else that was being done or built at that time. The oldness is something which comes later.
Yeah, and it's something that I think early Americans like Walter Hatch, I mean, they weren't trying to create something that was going to last forever necessarily. They were just trying to stay warm and survive. And it wasn't until much later when people started reflecting back on this idea of, oh, there's a continuum here. I'm part of a continuum. But I also think that one reason why people are so awed by old houses is that they survive and we don't. Like, we do pass through. And it reminds us of impermanence, not to be depressing, but it reminds us of something vaster and that we are just sort of partaking here for a short time.
Michelle joins us from Manning in South Carolina. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
What a lovely topic for you guys to have today.
Mm-hmm.
I had a
family home that now is no longer in the family. But when I was up till I was 4 years old, I was lucky enough to live in our family home. Someone passed away of my parents, and I was moved away. But I just recently, 2 weeks ago, went back up to upstate New York almost 40 years later, and it was very important for me to go to that prior existing home, which unfortunately has changed a lot. This home is, you know, of course, much older, and it's probably in the 100-year mark itself and not as well taken care of.
So what kind of emotions did you experience then as you saw it?
It's a connection to the past that I would have, you know, I probably would have been born, you know, raised there had not a parent passed away, and that would have been the home that I would have been raised in, similar to my older siblings. And it was important enough for me to take pictures, and I have an artist friend who is going to paint this home according to my memories. And that home will always be very special to me because I have very special toddler memories of that home full of laughter and love, and I know it's because of the home. And I just thought it was neat you had this program because even though it's been 40 years, that home is still very important to me, even though I wasn't lucky enough to grow up in it.
And the memories are still there, plainly.
Yes, they are. They are right there. And I think everybody that has an opportunity to have a sense of permanence in their home, that's what these homes represent to people, that it's who they are, and it helps to define them. Anytime I see an older home, a green home with a wide, sprawling porch and birdhouses, I immediately think of my home in upstate New York.
Michelle, thanks very much indeed. Sarah, would you ever try to create a home with a view that one day it will become a valued old home, if you see what I mean?
No, not anymore. You know, when I first started writing this book, I really had this feeling, like, what would happen to me if the Red House disappeared?
Yeah.
Would I disappear? You know, I was very over-identified with it. Would my sense of self be changed? And now that I've written the book and really spent a lot of time thinking about it, I think it's okay to recreate yourself and have a new home, just for the present, just to live in.
Old houses, old homes, silent witnesses to generations of history often. We're talking about how an old house becomes a home and what it can mean. Join us with your stories about your homes. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. My guests this hour, Sarah Messer and George Howe Colt, each has written about their old family home, the people who lived lived there before them and with them. We'd like to hear your stories about old homes you have known and loved. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. John's on the line from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Sarah, that's where your home was.
That's right.
John, hi.
Hello, Robin. Hi. Sarah, first of all, I'm very familiar with the Red House. It's a very nice street. I actually used to own a house in Pembroke, an old house in Pembroke that was owned by the branch of the Hatch family.
Great.
And they owned a mill, and there's all these stories. I've gone back to the deeds on that house. But I bought an old house in Marshfield about a year ago, but on South River Street. And it feels like home. I'm 35. I was in the house for 5 minutes when I was 19. And I was trying to get into the house since I was 19 after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I wanted to speak to was what Robin said at the top of the hour. Robin, you said you bought a house that someone had previously lived in, a writer had come back, and he wanted to experience the house one more time.
Yeah.
The problem I had after we bought our house is that the family that lived in the house in the 50s and 60s, they had owned it for a few generations, I think three generations it was in the family. The grandmother was dying of cancer, and the grandmother didn't come back to the house, but some of the grandchildren did. And for the first time, it was interesting. They pointed out some of the nooks and crannies and mentioned how the upstairs bathroom hadn't changed. I said, yeah, I noticed that. But also some of the graffiti in the basement and stuff like that. And also some of the stories how it was actually a two-family house where it was the same family, but it was divvied up into apartments. But then some more relatives started showing up, and then some more relatives started showing up. And at a point, we had to say, you know what? This is our house now. This is where I want to establish my roots.
Right.
So my parents are immigrants. You know, they came to this country. I grew up in the typical Boston three-family house. But now I'm here, and maybe I'm hooking into my, you know, my wife can go back to Hingham back in the 1630s. But I'm not trying to latch on to, you know, Americana. What I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to do is, this is how I want to raise my family. Would you please let us do it on our own?
Clearly, they're finding it difficult to let go, aren't they?
Right. But am I being, I feel a little guilty for being, not being rude, just saying, you know, hey, this is our house now, but this, there's some sense of places about certain houses, and people say it about my house all the time. They're like, oh, you bought that house? Yeah, I bought that house. I love it. And they're like, we love it too. Mm. But what I'm trying to say, am I buying into a product by saying, you know, here's this old house. Am I part of it now, or am I just using the product for my own sense of self?
You're not sure?
I loved the second I walked in the house, I said, I want to live here. And that was, you know, I was just this college kid. Mm. You know, I said, this is where I want to be. And luckily, I finally got it. But I don't know if I am. But it feels like home. Somehow older houses with big porches feel like home.
John, thanks very much for that. George, have you ever gone back?
To the big house, we still go back, but I once returned to another house that my family had lived in Connecticut for 3 years. And I, about 20 years later, I took a friend of mine. We happened to be passing through by that town. We got off the turnpike. I said, come and see where we lived for 3 years. I have a lot of memories about this place. And we went there. It was evening. And we walked onto the property, and we walked into the backyard, and I showed him the, you know, where we used to play baseball, where we'd found the snake that was eating the frog, where my brother used to hold me down and you know, drool on my face and things like that, all the old good memories. And all of a sudden, the door opened, a man stepped out of the house and said, "Who's out there?" And we ran to a corner of the property and climbed up a tree. I must have been 30 years old at the time. And, you know, instead of going up and saying, "Hi, my name is George Colt. We used to live here. I'm sorry. We don't mean to bother you." But I was terrified. But I also had that sense, as the previous caller, his visitors might have had, that, gee, even though we were only here for 3 years, this is my house too. Now, obviously, we can't, those of us who used to live in houses can't go back and camp on the lawns and, you know,
right,
keep them forever. And there is a limit. But I did feel this conflict of ownership almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew intellectually that it was his house, but I also felt, well, I have a right to be lurking in the shrubbery.
Because you share it somehow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sarah, what did you think as you listened
to John's
story? I think
that was such an interesting subject. I think ownership is what it is, because in America, you've got these, in that situation with that caller, you have this confluence of the old inhabitants feel a sense of ownership because of their genealogy and their heritage. And this is where my ancestors lived. And so this is a part of me. And then you have, you know, the other side of the American dream is you can recreate yourself. You can go from a Boston three-story house and buy a big old house in, you know, Marshfield and own it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got sort of the Great Gatsby kind of thing, and like the Puritan forebears kind of coming together in that moment. And it's a difficult one because I can understand both sides. You know?
I guess it's the difference between it's mine now, it's not yours anymore, and it's mine now, but you still have a part of it because you are part of its history. It's difficult.
Right. Go
on.
I just wanted to say that the Hatch grandchildren had never seen the Red House, and they came to the house on Sunday to see it for the first time.
This last Sunday?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was pretty great and kind of intense, too.
Because you could tell them a lot about...
Well, I think it's weird to have somebody who's not in your family telling you more about your family than you know, and then just showing you around the house. And
let's talk to Sidonie, who's on the line from Lafayette in Louisiana. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Do you have an old house?
Well, I grew up in a 140-year-old home. Whenever my parents bought it when I was about 5 years old, it still had an outhouse on the back porch.
Right.
It was probably about a block from a railroad. So a lot of conductors during the 50s, 60s actually boarded in the home. The original owner of the home had broken it into many apartments, and she lived in a small room in the back of the home, and which eventually became our living room. And so we would have several visitors that would come to our home and say, you know, well, my child was born here. and, you know, and many things like that. And it's just, it's interesting because not only did I have many memories there, but generations and generations also had memories at my home, too.
And good memories, it would seem.
Oh, well, there's good and bad. They have, it went through many, many hurricanes down here in Louisiana. And it's just amazing that, you know, it was made out of solid yellow cypress. And, I mean, it had never been painted, you know, the entire 140 years. And it just is solid as a rock.
Thank you, Sidoni, for that. George, shared memories is a large part of what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. And I guess the difficulty is when you're sharing them with people outside your own family. We were, lucky may not be the right word, but the big house was really, you know, in our family for the five generations. But it was also, there was a sense with the big house, it really was the biggest house in the area, and it was very prominent. And there was a sense also of sharing it with the rest of the summer community where we were. It's a house that they all knew very well, had been to many times, had played sardines, played tennis, you know, been to weddings there and so forth. And when it was put on the market, there was also a very great shared sense of loss among the community, and a feeling that we're all losing something, you know, that this house is kind of a bellwether for this particular area.
Sarah, can I just bring up something? I alluded to it briefly early on when I talked about the expense of keeping up an old house. Is part of what we're talking about just simply to do with the privilege of having money, that only people with a certain amount of cash can actually afford this kind of memory, this kind of sense of history that comes with living in an old house?
Yeah, and the other thing to think about, too, is that so the Hatch House was passed down for all those years, and Richard Warren Hatch, who sold it to my parents, his grandfather didn't have indoor plumbing, didn't have electricity, didn't have heat, and he put all those things in, and then that's when it starts to get expensive when you're... I mean, you can either live in a house that's falling down around you, or you can keep it up. And if you have to keep it up, it does cost money. And that's true. There is a privilege. And I feel very privileged that my parents were able to provide this for me and that I had such a great childhood.
I mean, George, you had a very privileged background. You came from a very established Boston family. Many people around the country, what we're talking about might seem almost completely strange and alien. They're happy if they can find any kind of home to live in.
It might seem strange and alien, but it's funny, at readings that I've given, people will come up to me afterwards and very apologetically saying, I'm sorry, I don't have a really big house. It doesn't have a tennis court. And I don't even have a summer house. I just have a little winter house that we live in all year round. But we love our house, and in writing about your house, although it was so different than my house and perhaps more grand in a certain sense, every home has those characteristics to people. Whatever your home is, it doesn't matter if it's 400 years old or if you just bought it, as one of the callers was saying recently, that's history, even if there's a month of it that's beginning to accrue in your
house. Okay, Ren is up from Holliston, Massachusetts. Ren, hi.
Good morning,
Ren. Good morning, hi.
Some 20 years ago, I owned this great barn of a place in Somerville that was a three-story Philly style that used to have a tin-man coal stove in the basement. And although I had replaced the furnaces in the dead of winter, it might get up to 55 in the living room. And that was reminded me from years later. I was coming home in the early morning, and there was a house fire in Natick. And I stopped the car and watched, and the firemen had decided to simply contain the fire. But I think the experience from the Somerville house and the history of an old house, because this was a turn-of-the-century house, I was watching this single-family wooden frame house go up in smoke, and I became almost spiritually attached to watching what I felt were memories. A history, a family's life going up in smoke with this building that was being allowed to die.
Sarah, you know about fires in houses.
That's right. The Red House, when we were trying to restore it, actually, in the 70s, caught on fire because of spontaneous combustion of rags. And we almost lost it. That was one of the questions. Do you want to save it? Do you want to keep it or not? Or restore it. And we restored it. But it's horrifying and scary to be in a fire in your house. But it's also just so horrifying to to see a burned house and to walk through a burned house, it's almost like a nightmare, you know. Everything is still there, but it's quite, you know, distorted and different and dark and smoke covered, and definitely that's a sad thing when a house burns down.
Rena, you're still there, are you?
I am.
You talked about the spiritual experience as you saw this.
Yeah, it was very odd because I felt connected somehow. There was a sadness to watching this history.
Because there was more to this house than simply...
It was not just wood and nails.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, the house I had in Somerville that somebody had attempted to modernize, so I'm looking at what used to be, you know, bric-a-brac and gingerbread stuff, and that had been paneled over, and piano windows that you could see from the outside, but the inside you're going, where the hell's the window? Mm. You know, it was behind panel. But you still felt a sense of history from that, and the house is still standing, and it's someone else is dealing with it. But this was a finality of a house. You know, I believe it was Sarah who made the mention of, you know, we are passing through, but the houses have permanence, usually, but not always. This house died in my lifetime, and the memories are all that's left of it. There is no structure that someone else can walk through and wonder about.
Thanks, Ren.
I think that's a lovely story, and I think that whether the house is lost to fire or development or some other way or just sold out of the family, that's the question. Where do these memories go? Where do those ghosts go? I used to imagine when the house was on the market, it became clear that what was probably going to happen was a good developer would tear it down and put something else up. And when I thought about that and thought about those walls coming down, I had this feeling that all the walls could come down, but there would still be this almost palpable, tangible structure that was still there, this air, this ghost-filled essence, and it would be in the shape of that house and it would still stand.
We will think much about old houses. We will think of our memories of old houses. My thanks to my guests, to Sarah Messer, author of Red House, George Howe Colt, author of The Big House. It's been a real pleasure. The Connection is produced by Nancy Cohen, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Orit Koritsky-Fox, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.